Enron was truly a trial of the century. It had everything: massive egos, bigger-than-life lawyers, and a massive fraud. On this special series from the Compliance Podcast Network, Tom Fox is joined by Lauren Steffi, who was a business journalist while it was all happening. Tune in for his reflections and new insights on the first trial of the century for the 21st century.
This is Tom Fox. I hope you will join me for my five-part series on a retrospective of the Enron trial. In episode one, Lauren Steffi and myself take a look at the prelude to the trial. We look at the accounting fraud that got Enron into trouble, the earnings restatement and the company's slide to bankruptcy, the criminal investigation and the arrest and the charges on the arrest, the unindicted co-conspirators, those who pled guilty, all leading up to the trial. I know you will enjoy episode one of the five-part series on the Enron trial.
Hello, everyone. This is Tom Fox, and I am joined by Lauren Steffi. Lauren actually attended the Enron trial, and we are going to do a five-part series on the Enron trial. I've been wanting to do the series for a long time, and it's going to be a ton of fun. So, Lauren, first of all, welcome, and thank you so much for doing this series with me.
Hey, thank you, Tom. I appreciate it.
So, Lauren, what were you doing in 2007, I think, that led you to cover the Enron trial?
So I was actually a business columnist for the Houston Chronicle. And, you know, if you recall, Enron collapsed in late 2001, and kind of the bankruptcy stuff sort of spilled into 2002. I was recruited to the Chronicle in sort of spring of 2004. And part of the reason was they really wanted to have a strong business columnist in place before the trial started, because, you know, it was obviously going to be a big story for the city of Houston. The trial actually started in 2006. It was spring of 2006.
So this episode is the prelude to the trial. So could you tell us a little bit about the backstory to Enron, the major failures, and what really led up to the point where the trial started?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little hard to believe 20 years removed from what happened, but Enron was the seventh biggest company in America, seventh biggest publicly traded company in America. And they had built, you know, their business originally around sort of traditional oil and gas and pipelines and, you know, sort of those kinds of physical assets. But they really made a name for themselves when natural gas trading was deregulated. And they basically created a trading platform that allowed people to very easily trade oil or trade natural gas contracts. And that became very successful. Their natural gas business was actually kind of the focal point of the company. But as it grew, they became more and more enamored with their own brilliance, and they sort of basked in their own hubris. And they began trying to take these trading mentalities, these trading platforms, and expand them to other markets, starting with things like water and then getting into more sort of, you know, ethereal ideas like trading broadband space on fiber optic networks, trading advertising space in newspapers and things like that. And because they were publicly traded, the pressure to show that these things were successful long before they'd even gotten off the ground just continued to intensify. And basically, the finance guys came up with a way to try to hide debt and make it look like the numbers were better than they were. That all worked great as long as the stock kept going up. But in mid-2001, the stock began to fall. People began to question the accounting and how viable some of these businesses were. As the stock fell, all this stuff began to unravel, and it really fell apart pretty quickly. I mean, I think it was the third quarter earnings report that came out in October of 2001 that really kind of exposed what had been going on. And the company was bankrupt by early December. So it went from being the seventh largest company in America to you know, being broke. Essentially, within less than 2 months, stock went from, I believe it was about $80 down to less than a dollar.
Lauren, the Department of Justice created an Enron task force, which investigated the accounting fraud and other criminal issues. We all thought, reading your column, this was taking forever, but they brought a large number of indictments and secured a large number of guilty pleas leading up to the trial. So I was wondering if you might talk to us a little bit about the arrest and some of the key charges.
Yeah, that was really the one of the stunning things about Enron as a corporate scandal. It was really the first time we saw this sort of widespread fraud. I mean, Enron got a lot of people to buy into this funny accounting that they were doing, and there were 100 unindicted co-conspirators in the case, which means these are people that the feds felt probably committed a crime, but for one reason or another, they decided not to pursue the case or not to pursue the charges. You know, there were dozens of indictments. There were, you know, most of the executives cut plea deals. Many of them agreed to testify against Ken Lay, who was the chairman, and Jeff Skilling, who was the former CEO by that point. The thing that's just we weren't prepared for, the thing that was so shocking from a business standpoint, is we'd really never seen a corporate environment. I mean, there had been cases of corporate malfeasance, you know, rogue executives who did things they shouldn't have, even CEOs who tried to line their own pockets. But we had never seen a corporate culture that was so focused on malfeasance as what we saw in the case of Enron. In looking back at it, it was a culture that really encouraged people to break the rules. And many, many people who, you know, did not think of themselves as rule breakers or doing anything wrong felt like they were doing what the company wanted them to do. And they kind of got sucked up in this big wave that ultimately imploded at the end of 2001.
There were a couple of specific strategies used by Enron that caught a lot of people's attentions. Probably the biggest one was the off-books partnerships, where they were able to hide debt. I was wondering if you could say a few words about that, because I've described some of those to people who are non-lawyers, and they look at me like, you made that up. No one would ever do that. And specifically about the Nigerian barge deal, but there were a whole series of those.
Yeah, there really were a series of them. And it actually started with an operation called JEDI. It was Joint Energy Development, Inc. And because the acronym was JEDI, it led to all these other partnerships that all had Star Wars names. But JEDI was originally done with a small company, a small oil and gas company in Dallas named Coda Energy. And they were basically pretty much a joint, you know, drilling deal like you would normally see with, you know, oil and gas companies. But what Enron did was they took the debt associated with all of that and they basically put it into this entity and then claimed that they had basically removed that debt from their books. That then became the model that they used, and they did it on a larger and larger scale. And the interlocking companies became more and more intricate, and they all held interests in each other and they passed debt back and forth. And I think the telltale sign that something was amiss was there was a partnership called LJM, which was run by the CFO, Andy Fastow. And it was where a lot of the debt was parked. And as you know from accounting rules, if an executive of Enron is an executive of the partnership, then those results have to be consolidated. In other words, that debt should have been on Enron's books. What Enron did was they basically tried to play cute. So if you go back to the 2001 proxy statement and 10K, the annual report, you'll see that in one of those documents, it says that LJM is a separate entity and it's run by an executive at Enron. Okay. And then if you read the other document, I think it's the proxy, says our CFO, Andrew Fastow, also runs a company called LJM Limited Partnership, but doesn't say that it's affiliated with Enron in any way. You had to sort of connect those two footnotes in two separate documents to realize the CFO of the company had his own partnership that was holding debt that had come from Enron and that was basically buying assets from Enron and taking things off the books. And so once that sort of was connected, it became very clear that all of this stuff should have been consolidated in Enron's financial statements. And it led to a massive accounting mess because some of these businesses weren't even real. And you mentioned the Nigerian barge deal, but I think the more egregious one was Enron Broadband, which was basically, we would now think of it as Netflix, right? It was this idea that you had fiber optic networks that were being developed and you were going to stream movies over these networks. And at the time, this was, you know, revolutionary. And Enron struck a deal with Blockbuster, which was a VHS rental company, right? They rented videotapes, which is the way we did it back in the day, kids. But anyway, the idea was Blockbuster would get content and put it on this network, and then you would subscribe and you'd be able to stream movies. Blockbuster backed out of the deal, but Enron had already booked 20 years of revenue in the current quarter. And so when all of this stuff unraveled, they basically had to take that away. And it's the only time in 30-some years covering business that I have seen negative revenue. I mean, basically, the only way they could make the books balance when they tried to restate was to start with a negative top-line number of something like $265 million or something like that. It was a huge number. And you just basically started with a hole, and then your expenses and stuff were added on top of that. So it was a really, really bizarre. By that point, things had clearly gotten way out of control.
The Department of Justice, as I said, put together the Enron Task Force, but also included FBI agents. And it was really, for me, sitting on the outside, a master class on how to investigate fraud by really starting at the bottom and working up the chain and getting the people to either flip and testify or bring charges and plead guilty. And that really led up to Andy Fastow. And so I was wondering, as we reach the end of this first episode, if you could say a few words about kind of that process you observed, but then the role of Andy Fastow, and then maybe preview his trial testimony, because he was a critical witness at trial.
Yeah, you know, so much of what happened at Enron was kind of the result of a partnership and really a very strong friendship between Andy Fastow, the CFO, and Jeff Skilling, who was the CEO. And Skilling had come out of McKinsey. He was very big on the idea of companies, you know, asset-light companies. We're not going to own stuff. We're going to trade stuff. We're going to create markets and manage markets and be the middleman, and that's how we're going to make money. In fact, he actually, under Skilling, they sold off a lot of their pipelines. And, you know, Rich Kinder was kind of the pipeline guy, the physical asset guy. He left and took most of those assets with him and formed Kinder Morgan. Obviously, you know, went on to become very successful in his own right. But Fastow was very much the kind of the engineer that made all these financial machinations work. And he was really an unusual CFO, because I remember one of the very first stories that I did on Enron, and this was back when I was still at Bloomberg, was trying to figure out who this guy was, this Andy Fastow guy, because you would talk to people on the street and they're like, yeah, he doesn't really run the earnings calls. We don't really hear from him. You know, he was kind of this behind the scenes guy, which normally, as you know, with a public company, the CFO is usually kind of the public face of finance. And that wasn't the case at Enron. Fastow was very busy setting up all these deals and partnerships and things like that. And he was really kind of an unknown. But he became a critical player in the trial because he decided to actually take a plea deal. And what he originally agreed to was a 10-year sentence in exchange for testifying against Lay and Skilling. And he was extremely convincing on the witness stand. Some of the jurors later said his testimony didn't influence them that much, but I think just as an observer in the trial, it was very striking. You know, he seemed very sincere in the fact that he believed that the company, that he had done things wrong, that he had committed crimes, the company had done things wrong. But he was able to really kind of crack open a lot of the financial deals and kind of walk people through what had happened. And I think his testimony, along with a few of the other finance guys, were pretty critical in showing that Lay and Skilling did, in fact, know what was going on at Enron.
Lauren, unfortunately, we are near the end of our time for this episode, but I hope our listeners will join us for part two, where the trial begins. I can't wait.
All right. Thanks a lot.
This is Tom Fox. I hope you enjoyed episode one of the Enron Trial five-part podcast series. In this episode one, we looked at the prelude to the trial. What got Enron into trouble? Why was their culture so corrupt? How did their culture corrupt people who would not normally be seen as corrupt and get them to engage in illegal activities as part of their ongoing business operations? We explore these and other questions with Lauren Steffi, former business columnist for the Houston Chronicle, who was covering Enron during its trial in 2006. We look at the off-books partnerships that Andy Fastow created for Enron, where they were able to hide corporate debt as Enron became more and more cash poor from their operations in the late 90s, moving to their devastating bankruptcy in December of 2021. These off-books partnerships were eventually discovered, and they were required to be disclosed, and that led to the death spiral of Enron. We take a look at Jeff Skilling, who became the CEO of Enron in early 2001, and 6 months later, suddenly resigned from a position. What did Skilling know? What did he find out? What did he not know that he found out as CEO? And why did he resign? These are questions that are still many people are asking today. And of course, we explore that. What was the impact of the Enron fraud and bankruptcy on individual Enron employees who had, many had invested their entire retirement in Enron stock? And what did the devastation of the bankruptcy mean for them? These are some of the stories that we begin to explore in this episode one. We also take a look at the Enron Task Force, the Department of Justice's group that investigated Enron, including the DOJ prosecutors and the FBI agents who led the investigation. We look at the arrests and charges of many of the Enron executives. Most pled guilty, but two notable, Jeff Skilling and Ken Lay, did not plead guilty and actually went to trial, which of course we'll explore in other episodes. We talk about the absolute insaneness of many of the Enron fraud schemes, including the Nigerian barge deal and others that almost everyone recognized were unethical and wrong, even if they didn't know the specific accounting rules. So how did Enron go into a death spiral? What was the culture that allowed not only the creation of the off-book partnerships, but their continued use? Why didn't Ken Lay know about any of these during his tenure as CEO and when he came back as CEO after Jeff Skilling resigned? What role did Sharon Watkins, the whistleblower, play in bringing all of this information to light? These are questions that we start to explore in part one of our five-part series, all, of course, leading to the trial of Jeff Skilling and Ken Lay. I hope you'll join myself, Tom Fox, and Lauren Steffi on our five-part exploration over the next five episodes on the Enron trial, why it was so important at the time, and why it still resonates. Enron bankruptcy 20 years later, and the Enron trial some 15 years later.